This is the Game Designers of North Carolina podcast.
Hello, and welcome to episode 3 of the Game Designers of North Carolina podcast, the longest named podcast in the business. My name is Matt Wolf, and I am your host. Our topic for this podcast is iterating a design. And to discuss this topic, I have two designers who both have experience with iterating a design while getting those designs all the way ready to be published. Our first designer joins us this evening has far too many games to his credit for me to go through, and that is Daniel Solis. Hey, Daniel.
Hello.
And our other designer today is the designer of Canada's most hated game, and that is Graham Russell. Hey, Graham.
Hey, Matt. You know, we'll talk about this later, but you've had a busy week. How are you holding up?
It was exciting. Yeah, but you're right. We'll talk about that later. Yeah. Now, before we get to our main topic, first we're going to do our little designer discovery segment where we're going to get to know a little bit more about Daniel and Graham. It may not be too much new for our listeners for Daniel because he's pretty open, but I'm not sure how much people are familiar with Graham. So, Graham, we're actually going to start with you then.
Sure.
So, why did you start designing tabletop games?
I mean, that's always the toughest question, right?
That's why, like, we start with it.
Why? I like making systems. I like making interfaces. I like creating ways to interact that are structured. That has defined a lot of what I've done in my life, from doing graphic design work to editing or game design or whatever it is. I like structure in a lot of ways, and game design is one of the ways I really get to have creativity through structure.
So it's like an innate need for yourself?
Yeah. Hmm. You know, I'm a little OCD. Everything needs to be in its right place, you know. But when you're designing something, that's an asset more than a liability.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I'm trying to think of how many designers are actually OCD, and I bet it's a surprising number, you know, that at least have that tendency because they want to have things neat and orderly, and others, of course, are very messy, like me. But so Daniel, how about you? Why did you start designing tabletop games?
It's kind of a weird condition. I don't know if it's a diagnosable pathology, but
that seems to be how we're starting. So yeah.
Yeah.
It's certainly something that I've sort of habitually done for a long time, and only now have I sort of managed to sort of come out with a weird way of getting paid to do it. And I think that's mainly why I'm doing it now, is that it's a fun thing to do that touches on a whole bunch of different subjects that I'm interested in, from like psychology to some rudimentary math and economics and behavioral science and cognitive studies and all that stuff. And also, just on top of that, the graphic design challenges of and interface and user experience. It basically touches on so much stuff that I'm really interested in that I would be doing this regardless. But now that I have the time to actually do it full time, it's just been fun, and I haven't been able to stop.
So, like, all these various interests you have, it's kind of like all blends into to kind of feed what you want to do for game design.
Yeah, basically, it gives me an excuse to study all these like weird, obscure like periods of history, or to follow some weird whim that I have at any particular moment. I can justify by saying, "Hey, this could be a game sometime."
That's how I justify buying games. I'm like, Marcy, I need to play this and see how it works. You know,
oh, yeah,
yeah.
I gotta keep up to date.
That's right. Yeah, that too. Yeah. So, Daniel, when did you start designing tabletop games?
Five years ago, 10 years ago, depending on how you count it.
It's up to you.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, yeah, how do you count it?
Yeah.
The weird thing is I got my start in role-playing games, and I think that was mainly because that was what I was surrounded by. I knew a lot of independent role-playing game designers, and when I started trying my hand at it, I found that I wanted more structure than most role-playing games had by their nature. And I ended up designing games that were more like board games than they were traditional, what do you think of as role-playing games, even from the indie side. Like, these things were just way more draconian in their structure than most role-playing games were from that time period. So from there, I started learning more about board game design and seeing more people who were doing that. Kickstarter came around, and that's when I got exposed to a lot more designers in the trade. And that's when I started, like, kind of allowing myself to design games that weren't ostensibly storytelling or role-playing oriented, but more about the mechanics and more about the just the more abstract experience of playing a game, still with some theme. But yeah, that's how long I've been doing it.
So you said you were kind of surrounded by RPGs. So it's just like the people that were in your life, they were playing RPGs more than like board games and card games?
Definitely, yeah. A lot more D&D and some more obscure stuff. Like there was a parody D&D game called Hackmaster that a bunch of my friends in college played sincerely. And I don't think it was ever designed to actually be played. I think it was all mostly a joke, but they played it sincerely. And that was kind of my first taste of non-irony as well, which is kind of fun. But then they occasionally played a board game like Catan. They played Starfarers of Catan first, and that was what I had been exposed to first before Settlers of Catan. And they played Risk 2210, which was really the first Risk that I played before, like, the basic Risk. I had weird backwards exposure to a lot of board games.
That's definitely a little unique, yeah. Yeah, most people at least played the version of Risk that came with Castle Risk, and at least kind of started there. That was it's actually not a bad one, because that was the one where you could end the game early if you took someone's castle instead of having to defeat them off the map, and that was so it was a way to speed it up. It was pretty nice. So, Graham, when did you start designing tabletop games?
So I messed with things when I was a kid. I had little card games, little board games, pen and paper games. Kind of whenever I had a free moment, I made a little game for myself to keep myself busy. But nothing was serious until, I guess, when I got to college. There was a game night group that would get together and play board games and video games and all that. And there I met Brad Talton, who now runs Level 99 Games. And we kind of worked on games together for a year or two there. It was fun to have a collaborator and to really, you know, meet someone who had this passion too. And we would work on things generally together, but occasionally we'd do our separate projects and bring them and, you know, have the group be our guinea pigs and things like that. That was a lot of fun. As a result, kind of the gears started turning, and now that's just what I have going on in my head all the time.
What school did you go to?
UNC.
Oh, I did not know that Brad went to UNC as well. Okay.
Oh, yeah. Huh. Yeah.
Yeah, that's very cool.
He is a game designer of North Carolina.
Yeah, well, we should have him on the show then. Yeah. Yes, if he's even aware of this podcast, which he probably isn't, but that's okay. So Daniel had some experience doing some RPGs. Do you have any other experience designing games in any other medium?
So most of my experience with games, at least, you know, before the last, you know, decade or so, has been in more the criticism side. I've worked writing about and editing and all that stuff with video games mostly, but some board games too. As far as designing things, it's generally been passion project. So I don't have a lot of specific stuff in other media where I've really gotten to get into that stuff, especially because you think something like a video game, there's very little you can do as a solo developer with that kind of thing. Whereas with board games, you can just kind of do the whole thing, especially if you have a little bit of talent with editing or graphic design or what have you, and enough to get you going at least, then you can kind of be a one-man shop where, you know, programming, art sort of stuff, it's a more involved thing. So that's one of the reasons I like, you know, doing card and board games.
So, Daniel, when you got started kind of shifting from RPGs to board and card games, what kind of surprised you the most about that experience?
Honestly, it was so much easier to iterate and develop a board game and card game than it was a role-playing game. I think role-playing games, there was sort of a presumption that a role-playing game had a group of people, usually like 4 to 5, sit down for about 2 hours in the indie community that I was more a part of. Usually there was like some emotional weight to this, and you would like get into character, and there was some interesting systems, but at the same time there was assumptions about character ownership and that there was one player who was a DM or a GM who's kind of governing things. And then when I went over to board games and card games, what I just absolutely loved was that I was very much freed from those presumptions, that I could really focus on new mechanics and new experiences and gameplay that were faster, way less production involved, so that I can just have a session done in like 20 minutes, 10 minutes, 15 minutes, and then take knowledge from that experience and then iterate and revise and bring it back to the table just a few minutes later and actually have that be a complete playtest session rather than waiting sometimes weeks or months to get another playtest in to get everybody on the same page to just get everything coordinated. It's just faster. I loved it. I loved how much faster it was.
Cool. Yeah, I've never played an RPG, so I have no experience at all in terms of, like, you know, what they're about. Or, I mean, I know at a high level what they're about, but, like, you know, developing them or anything like that. So that's really interesting how, you know, people would be so into it and it would take so much time to get through. I guess you almost take it for granted how relatively rapidly you can do it in the board and card game world. How about you, Graham? When you got started, what kind of surprised you the most?
You know, I think the biggest thing to me was how starkly good and bad design shows in board games. You know, with something like a video game or something more involved, you can kind of coat bad design with high production values.
And you can do that in board games, too.
Yeah, well, you can still have a good experience with, you know, a rather mundane game that is cinematic or has, like, great storytelling and voice acting and all that, but, like, the experience of, you know, you hit the X button and somebody slashes something, like, this is not great. With a board game, you can coat on those production values and have, you know, nice miniatures for your game. But when people play the game, it's not going to be a fun game just because you have nice miniatures. It'll just be a thing on your shelf. Oh, look at these nice miniatures. I don't want to play this game, but look, isn't it great?
I don't know. I think there are some games where they do have, like, a very high production values, and people incorporate that into their feelings about the game, whether they know it or not. And so, like, the game might not be that good, but because it's produced so well, they feel a little bit better about it. But I think generally you are right, where it's really tough to kind of paper over really poor design in a game. It would have to be something extraordinary, or you'd have to have, like, the exact right group experience for that game to kind of paper over that.
There's something to be said for the experiential aspect of having these things, right? You know, it's the same reason that people like vinyl or people like, you know, the ritual of things, that's important. Mm-hmm. But if you ask people, is this a well-designed game? They can think about it and, like, oh, this isn't great. But, you know, you talk about, like, a video game, it's hard for them to be like, well, no, there was this really cool cutscene where this guy fell off and, like, the face looked real. And, like, it's hard to separate that from the gameplay, right?
The inverse question of this is, so Graham, what was exactly as you expected it to be?
Oh, man. I the printing bills?
Yeah.
In college, I racked up such a cost at the local, you know, at the time, Kinko's. Just, hey, here's, you know, print off 12 more sheets of cardstock for me. I'll see you next week. That was what I expected it to be. I definitely skipped a couple lunches to pay for game design in college.
Oof. That's dedication.
Yeah.
All right.
Oh, yeah.
Jeez, man.
How about you, Daniel? What was just as you expected it to be?
Honestly, the thing that I knew would be tough is actually getting on the radar of a game publisher during recruiting or anything like that. Just making those connections, I knew it was going to be tough because they even before Kickstarter and all that, you always had someone coming in from somewhere and bringing their game or their invention and showing it off to somebody and hoping that they're going to have the next big thing. And now there's just even more competition for that, of course. But when I was just starting out, I knew that I needed to figure out a way that I could make a name for myself or kind of gain exposure and kind of do that legwork without breaking the budget. Because I mean, just like everybody else, I'm trying to, like, kind of get by, you know. So that's what led to all, like, the blogging and all that stuff. But basically, it was just a lot of hustling. Like, I knew I had to blog consistently. I knew I'd have to do other stuff that's online that's very visible. Do other things that would perhaps go against my instincts. Like, just like everybody else, I kind of started with a little bit of preciousness about my designs. That like, oh, I don't want anybody to steal my ideas. Yada yada yada. All that stuff. I had to fight through that just because I knew that the only way I was gonna get any exposure or even get playtesters even is by being more visible about my development process. And that's kind of how all that started. And I knew that was going to be tough for when I was getting started, but it worked. Hey.
Yeah. And your blog post about, you know, no one's going to steal your idea, I think that's gone viral like 7 or 8 times now, you know, and it's true though. Yeah. I mean, that's so unimaginably rare, people getting into the, you know, the design space for the first time. They just don't realize that. All right, so the last question is, and we'll start with Daniels, what piece of advice would you give to a new designer?
I would say that, you know, normally I was going to say that the things that other designers who have been on the show so far have already said.
You can't say that, yeah.
I know, right? Because I would say normally start small, and I would normally say start start your second project first, so that you don't invest too much emotion into your baby when you haven't had developed the skills to really give it justice. So those things haven't been established already in the canon of the podcast.
Yes.
I would say, like, kind of check your ego, but not in the sense of like checking your arrogance. Like, because I don't think that's a problem for a lot of designers. I think most designers are in their heart of hearts, they kind of have a little bit of imposter syndrome. Like, oh, is this game any good? And that's what leads to the defensiveness about it. It isn't necessarily that they think it's really amazing. It's just that they're kind of defensive. They're not sure whether it's actually good or not. And so that's what leads to that apprehension about actually getting that first playtest in or getting that first prototype done, is that you're never quite sure that it's really ready, because your sense of taste, Ira Glass says this all the time, is that your sense of taste exceeds your ability to actually produce. That you know what a good game is, but you also, with that sense of taste, can tell when a game that you're designing isn't quite good enough yet. And so you're hesitant to show it to anybody because you want to respect the tester's time or for whatever reason. And so in that sense, I think just the skill that you have to really establish as a designer, especially, or any public creative, if you're doing this professionally, is that you just have to be able to put yourself out there and understand that sometimes you're going to face rejection, but it's okay, and that's part of the learning and iteration process.
So you attribute that to imposter syndrome. That's interesting. I always attribute it to so much personal ownership of your creation that you can't separate you from your creation. You know, so you feel like if someone is criticizing your creation, they're criticizing you, which is not true. And I think that's a leap that at least I had to make early on. But that's really interesting to attribute it to imposter syndrome. I hadn't thought about that, but I think there's definitely some truth to that. How about you, Graham? What piece of advice would you give?
So I think, you know, when starting out with your first design, and really any design, but it's really helpful with your first, boil it down to the nugget, whatever you can get by with unadorned, as simple and streamlined as you can, and then cut one more thing. Not only should you start by doing as contained and easy to test a thing as possible, and then you can always add things on later, I think it's important to challenge what you believe the must-have should be. And if you cut this one more thing, you're probably cutting the thing you're most unsure of. And I think if you go through that and you see, well, actually, no, it did need that thing, then you've tested that for yourself. But once you've gone past that, and really, as we're going to talk about later, iterating, building on it, then it's tough to revisit that core of what it is you really think the game's about. So I think making sure, you know, even testing yourself on what that is important as your first step.
I think that is something, you know, cutting it down to a real manageable chunk and possibly beyond what you think you should cut it. I don't hear that so much. I usually hear cut so you can't cut anything, you know, like that kind of advice, but not even potentially go further than that, which is a really good way to know when you've cut too much. And, you know, and then you're like, oh, I got to bring that back. Yeah.
It's good to be a little bit ruthless with your darlings.
Yeah, you got to be the evil stepmother to them sometimes. Yeah. Now we're going to move into our main topic for this episode, which is going to be iterating a design. And what I mean by iterating, in case we're using verbiage that anyone's not familiar with, is essentially making revisions to your design, or and those could be substantial revisions, it could be minor, and we're going to get into those kind of things. Taking it from where it currently is, making changes, retesting, incorporating feedback, making changes, retesting, things like that. So those are all iterations. So what we'll start off with here, this is going to be, I suspect, is going to be the most difficult question. So that's, of course, we're going to start with this. So you have a prototype, and you play tested it. It may have been solo, or you may have put it in front of some people. Mm-hmm. How do you choose what you should change for the next iteration of that design? And whoever wants to start first can go ahead.
Yeah. So I think it's interesting that both Daniel and I we're here for this, because
there's a reason.
The feedback that you get as a game designer and the feedback that you get from clients in a graphic design environment are very similar, mm-hmm. in that your role is there to be the content expert, you know, the person who knows what they're doing, but you're making this for others. You know, you're making this for someone else. So when they have feedback, it's really important that you take it into account. But also, they might not have the vocabulary to address what it is that's going wrong. I think especially the thing that I've seen is people will try to offer solutions more than expressing what it is that is wrong. And that's not their fault, you know, especially if they're not game designers, then they don't necessarily need to have the skills to diagnose what's wrong. But I think it's your job as a designer to look at the situation, see what's causing those problems, and address those rather than trying to say, oh, well, they wanted the game to last longer, so let's add two turns.
So you're saying basically like root cause analysis.
Right.
Yeah. See, I come from the software world, so that's my vocabulary is, you know, you ask a lot of questions, you know, why, and hear what they're saying, but don't listen to what they're saying, which sounds horrible, know, but it's
true.
I think
you just have to translate it into, again, you're the expert at the thing, so you need to hear them and adjust what they're saying to fit reality.
Yeah. How about you, Daniel? If there's like a specific situation you're thinking of that might help to ground, but how do you choose what you're going to change, you know, for the next iteration of a design?
So, I mean, I guess on a more specific example, kind of anecdotally, the way I used to design was and do iteration and change things was I used to have questionnaires, and after every playtest, I would have people fill out their questionnaire and answer questions and all that. And I thought that was an objective way to kind of get feedback on something, especially for blind playtests that where I wasn't present. But since then, I've become, whether by laziness or I like to think this is from experience more than anything.
They may be synonyms. I don't know.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah. What I do now is whenever I'm doing a playtest and I'm at the table and teaching and observing, I look for points where people check out, and I make a note of what's happening in the game at that moment when people check out, when they sigh, when they get their attention distracted by something, when people have questions about rules. That's usually a big exclamation point. Circle that. Come back to that later. If people get rules wrong, that's an amazingly informative and painful, but also really, really educational experience to have as a designer, because you're realizing, oh, how people expect this to work is completely different from how it actually works. Should I change the game to fit the expectation, or should I just frame the game better so that the expectations are adjusted before they get to that point when there's confusion? And I do that for every game, but in particular for games like Trickster, where I'm doing different sets of the game with unique variations in the rules with each set, but the core system stays the same. Mm-hmm. I'm literally playing with expectations with each one of those sets, and so I'm having to figure out, okay, if I have seven different effects in this one set, how do they interrelate with each other? What are the synergies? Are they obvious to most players who have experienced the game before? Or if they're coming into it new, are they easy to grasp, even though they may not have played any of the other Trickster sets? Also, those are things I'm accounting for whenever I test out a new set. And when I do blind play testing in particular, I ask the questions that I have to ask, like, have you played Trickster before? If not, what did you think about this? How long did it last? How many people were at the table? Were there any distractions around? Those kinds of things that I normally would observe by myself without having to ask the questions. Those are the things I have to ask blind playtesters because I'm just not there. So once I've gotten that feedback about length of the game, where people are getting bored or getting confused, that's when I know that I need to address something there. And like Graham said, it's a lot of it is diagnosis. Like, you're a doctor, you're getting reports of symptoms, but you're the doctor, so you know how to actually treat those symptoms. Whereas the patient may not know how to do that, but they're the ones who are presenting you those symptoms, and so you have to take what they say seriously. You know, try not to be condescending and appear to have checked out despite any impulse you may have to do so. Like, you have to hear everything they're saying, because especially if there's solutions that they're offering, because they're essentially giving you the outlines of what the problem is, and so you can kind of mentally fill in those outlines even though they can't.
Yeah, so we're like doctors,
yeah.
But let's be clear, we're not doctors. Please don't come to us for medical advice. We don't have those degrees. Please.
I don't think anyone has those degrees in the group. I don't know. Someone might have a hidden past we don't know about.
Wow. Surprisingly few medical professionals in game design.
I think
they're too busy.
I know a few.
Yeah. I really like the doctor metaphor. I don't think I've heard that specifically before, but I think that that's a really apt comparison, and it's a way better way to say it than the way I said it. Hear, but don't listen. That's the that comes from
but don't listen to what we say. Yeah. Get so that, the gist of it.
That's right. Yeah. Now there's a really interesting distinction between, you know, having non-designers play and have designers play, and that's completely different feedback sets, but that's kind of out of scope for this podcast. So the next question would be then, how many times do you play test a specific iteration before you make changes? And this most likely is going to depend on the kind of the stage that you feel your game is in. So how about you, Daniel? How many do you do? Do you do one? Do you do a lot?
My problem is that I'm too ruthless. I throw the baby out with the bathwater all the time, and I have a strong impulse to change everything between every playtest. That's the bad way to do it. Don't do that, because then you don't get any real verifiable data from each playtest. You kind of ruin the test when you do that. And so the rule of thumb that I've given myself, that I don't necessarily always hold to, but it's the goal I try to have, is that when I test for the first time, I allow myself to change the prototype after that first test. And then I test twice, and I don't allow myself to change the prototype until after the second test. And then again after three more tests, and then again after four more tests, and progressively I force myself to stick to a prototype for longer periods of time so that I can understand the nuances of what's going on with each one of those play tests, and kind of like it hurts sometimes because I know I want to change a particular thing, but I'm sticking with that prototype and I'm gonna push it through for that one more play test because I know there's gonna be something really interesting that comes out of that, despite being aware that there's a problem here.
So how long have you been trying to stick to kind of that system?
It's really been a thing past 3 years when I started aggressively developing and releasing card games through print on demand. That's something I had to be very vigorous about making sure. And the trouble is knowing when you're done. Like after you're getting into like the sixth cycle of that kind of testing, is it done? Like are you ready? Like, do you need to go over that seventh cycle and then an eighth cycle? Things start getting progressively like harder to tease apart after a certain point. And it is entirely possible for a game to be overworked. It's hard to tell when to stop at that point. But that rapid release cycle and that schedule was what really drove me to get a stronger system in place for my development process.
Cool. How about you, Graham? How many times do you play test before making changes?
So I think the important thing to know is that the amount of times you need to play it really differs wildly depending on the type of game you're making.
Oh, yeah.
So the games that I've been developing for the last couple of years are heavily socially driven. So there's a play test and it goes wrong, but it doesn't, you know, I'm not sure whether it went wrong because of the game or because, you know, someone checked out. Or there was, you know, there's a lot of social aspects to a social game, and there should be. You know, that's part of the appeal of those games, is that it is about the personalities at the table. But I really need a lot more playtests to see if something is a problem. So you really have to get in a lot for something like that. But if you're doing like a mechanics-based game, like a Euro, where, okay, you know, you've played it twice now and the point swings are ridiculous, well, okay, that's much easier to diagnose. So you can make those sorts of changes faster. The thing that I think applies to all games, though, is the further down the road you get, the more careful you should get about what you're changing. I think once you start it, you can change course as much as you want. But if, you know, you're at the point where you've been working on this for a while, for, you know, maybe a month or two, and you've gotten it to where it needs to be, don't be afraid to change it. But make sure you have the evidence to make sure that's what you're doing and that you're not just trying to be a perfectionist about it and never actually letting yourself finish it.
We're definitely going to have you back on when we do the social games episode.
Yeah. Sure.
Yeah.
It's interesting because I'm not a huge social game guy, but I think the projects that I pick are because I see a way I'd like a game to work or be better that it's not. You know, since there aren't a lot of social games out there that I like, I have ideas for things that could work. So I have a lot of experience making them now, but I like a lot of mechanics-focused, you know, sort of variable-type games. But it's interesting how this sort of field I've found myself in.
So you're kind of exploring the white space of existing social games in a way?
Yeah. I mean, so both The Fittest, my first game, and Party Politics, the game I'm working on now, both came about because of a social dynamic I didn't see in games. You know, there's this sort of space in between competitive and cooperative that has a lot of room there that isn't just about, you know, oh, this Euro has different worker placement for points, and we have different variables in our worker placement game. The base interaction of social games is the game, and I'm interested in, yeah, exploring the sort of blue sky approach with that.
Okay. So let's talk about specifics. So Graham, for the fittest, do you recall, you know, when you were going through the development cycle there, roughly how many times you would kind of play test before making changes for a new iteration?
So that was an interesting thing, right? Because that game started in 2006, and that game got published in, you know, late 2013, 2014. So that was a really long development cycle. The final game, as it really was part of, you know, the Dice Hate Me 54 card challenge. So that was a pretty rapid final step, and I had a deadline. Mm-hmm. So I tried to play. I knew I had 4 weeks. I played it at least 3 times during a week. Getting together 6 people for a social game, actually pretty difficult.
yeah.
Surprise. And then I would allow myself to change it every week. Mm-hmm. And that really encapsulated it. I like small structures, and I also like time crunches because they really make you focus on getting the job done. There, you know, you're kind of pushed, but in a way, trial by fire works.
Oh yeah, I'm not going to say I'm a big fan of trial by fire, but it works. Well, yeah,
I know Daniel had some similar stuff when he was trying to put out a game a month, where he was also like, "All right, well, this file's got to be uploaded, or else I got to, you know, bail." So, I think there a lot of interesting ideas came out of that.
Yeah, the philosophy that I took from indie role playing games was better is the enemy of done. That you can just work and work and work at something indefinitely, but it's never going to be perfect. But it can be done. So I tend towards the finishing rather than the perfecting. Perhaps that's a liability as a designer, but I have at least a catalog. I can say I've accomplished things, as small as they may be, they're done.
Yeah, and I imagine that a lot of people listening to this podcast don't have a finished game, right? Like, they're just getting into it, or they've done some hobby things. Getting things done makes you better at getting things done, and then you can get better things done.
Nice.
You need to be good at getting things done first, or you're never going to get anything.
I want to see that slogan on a t-shirt.
Yeah, that needs to be that needs to be the Game Designers of North Carolina shirt. Right?
Okay.
Yeah, maybe at Unpub 6 we can all have shirts. Yeah, okay. Actually, that's I'll write down a note, because that's actually a pretty damn good idea. So Daniel, do you want to talk about one of the designs you've put out and kind of your iteration process for that design? And it can be anyone you want. It could be one that was challenging, or maybe one that was easy, maybe one that was new or recent, I should say, whatever kind of one you want to talk about.
One of the things that way back in the day when Love Letter first came out, everyone was working on a micro game. Everyone was kind of like, oh man, you can make a game with just 18 cards. And so everybody was kind of like trying their hand at the challenge of working within those confines. And like a smart guy, I decided 18 cards is too many. Like, let's go with something even smaller. Let's say if you have 3 to 4 players and you had 12 cards, then those divide evenly. What if you just added a 13th card so that there's a secret card that no one else can see, and everyone's trying to suss out what that card is based on the limited information they have in their hand? And that all spun out into a game that eventually became Suspense. That was a game that I had in my back pocket at one of the, I think, Unpub 3 or 4, back when it was still at the school cafeteria. That was the same year that I had Bill of the Ball, and so I was playtesting Bill of the Ball as my main thing, but then occasionally, like, in between sessions or out, like, after hours, I had this thing in my back pocket, and I felt like kind of a weird, like, back alley smuggler, because I would be like, hey, you want to see something cool? I've got a 13 card deduction game. You want to see it?
You need a hit. You need a hit of cards,
And it worked. I got people to like. We just grabbed like bench space or table space because it was an immensely like tiny. There was very little footprint for this thing, and we just played like a quick hand, and they would like get it. And it had a different theme at the time. It was one of those things where it was challenging because when I was doing that whole delivery and kind of and being in an environment where people are ready to playtest, and so the sense of danger almost when you can kind of like do an after hours off the books kind of playtest that's really, really quick, there's a certain allure to that that I think was muddying my perceptions of how well the game was actually performing. And so I had to take a more objective look at how the game was working, where some problems were, if there were any real bugs, and make that distinct from how I was delivering the game. It's a weird problem. I don't think a lot of people necessarily have that issue, but it's something that I had to deal with quite a bit because I was like having fun pitching it, and that in turn was muddying my perceptions of whether the game itself was fun or whether I was just having fun delivering it.
You're not the only person that has that issue.
But yeah, I mean, that was a challenging thing. And so that took time to develop that and polish that up. And I went through a number of different themes trying to figure out whether a different theme would make it a little bit easier to understand, what metaphors I could do to explain that one card is hidden and that one player can see it. Like for a time, it was an alien theme, so everybody was trying to get to the escape pod, which is like hidden on the ship, and so that's what the secret card was. And the reason one player knew where that escape pod was is because they were the android who was sent by the company to like betray everybody. And it was a real stretch to explain all that stuff. So eventually, I just settled on no theme at all and just kind of let it like rest on the mechanics on its own, more or less. That took time. It was tough. It was a tough design, but I think it worked out.
So when you had that at Unpub 3, because at Unpub 4 you had the River Agent, because my first Unpub. When you did a playtest, was it the same from playtest to playtest, or did you do little tweaks in between? How did you manage that during con?
When I was doing Suspense, it was slight tweaks here and there. I think during that Unpub, it went from a game where you could not fold, like you were on the hook the whole time, to one where you could like pass, so it's kind of like a soft fold, and then you could just like fold entirely, so you're just completely out of the game entirely. And adding those two options were a big help to get people ironically more invested, oddly enough. It's a weird poker concept that getting out of the game is a strategic choice, but it's something that I think fit with the way the game felt at the time, because it is a kind of a bluff. It is kind of like a deduction thing. So I thought, well, what the heck? Poker's been doing it for however many years. I'll try it. And it worked. It was little things like that. It was more systematic. And partly, I think the beauty of Unpub is that you have very limited time to change your physical components. And you have no access, especially back when it was at a cafeteria, you had no access to a printer or anything else. You're stuck with whatever you brought with you. And so the only changes that I could make at the time were procedural, how people take turns, who takes the first turn, what can you do on your first turn, little things like that. And I think that was the most helpful thing to work on, was like how much can I change without having to change the prototype itself.
Yeah, at Unpub, I've actually changed rules in the middle of explaining the game, and it's like this actually happened at Unpub 5 with, at the time it was Rocket Powered Avalanche, and now it's Avalanche at Yeti Mountain, and I didn't have a good way to resolve ties on the mountain. People would share spaces, and as I was explaining it to, I don't know, like the fifth playtest group of the day, it just occurred to me, why should they share spaces? Why don't they just go to the next available space? And that little tiny tweak just opened up this really interesting strategic element of trying to play a low card, knowing that you're going to be able to go further because everyone's going to be in front of you and you're just going to be able to ski on by past them. And, I remember very vividly pausing while I'm explaining and kind of looking up like, yeah, let's try that. Yeah. And then we did it and it was awesome. And yeah, it's just in the middle of explaining.
So I'm just curious, yeah. Did anyone complain about sharing spaces in the previous five playtests?
It had been an issue since the beginning because trying to resolve ties was problematic. So if you were in the same space and you had the same speed, who would go first? Yeah, and there was a tiebreaker marker that you would just pass around the table. I hated that. I hate ties in general in games, and I try to design games to avoid ties as much as possible. Ask Josh Mills about that if he's listening to this, Josh Mills. And by eliminating that tie, all that left was if people played the same speed. In that case, it was whoever was furthest back would go first. Mm-hmm. And so that was a tiebreaker that was easy to implement. Yeah,
right. And I think what makes that aha moment so much better is that you had less game and better game at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, oh, yep. Wait a minute.
Yeah.
This is great. This is simpler, but this is also like a better game.
Yep. That was
which
exactly
is a
it.
Lot of fun.
Yeah. The way you said the aha moment, and that's exactly what it is when you discover those things in any design. Like, oh, wow, that totally works. That, yes, we're going to run with that. We're going to do that. That's awesome. Yeah, and that was, you know, just talking about Unpub 3 kind of reminded me of doing those rapid changes. So this is a unsolicited ad for Unpub 6. everyone should go there. Yeah. So when you are iterating a design, do you prefer to make like one change? Do you prefer to make multiple changes? Something in between? Graham, we'll start with you.
So it's tough to make multiple changes and see what effect each of the changes had, right? I think if you have disparate aspects of your game, where if you can make multiple changes that don't really interact with each other, for example, even just a simple game like, I'm working on Party Politics. If there's an issue with templating, like, you know, this sort of way you're saying things and the way you're putting things on your cards that is confusing, you can do that and also figure out like a mechanics thing. And you can probably tell those differences. But if you're adjusting two different variables in your game, the simpler the change you can make, the better. Of course, the conflicting part of that is, you know, what if you want to get more done quickly? You got to restrain yourself.
So I guess you'd say if your changes are in different categories, it would be a little bit safer to do?
Yeah. But if, like, you can just do one thing, that is the best. If you can do straight up A-B testing, here is the thing with one change, then that is the best way to iterate. It's also the slowest way to iterate. You can have things good or fast. You know, it's one of those trade-offs.
Yeah, the good, fast, cheap triangle. Yeah.
It's never cheap. Look, don't go into board game design thinking you're going to. I don't know how Daniel makes money. It's unclear. I am under so much of a debt and paper. It is what it is. But yeah, no, you can. There's a point at which you have to get things done. But if you have the time, try one thing. Also, if you have two problems, you can fix both of them with one thing. If you can force yourself to design one thing that fixes it rather than two, that might be the best solution.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. Yeah, it's one stone for two birds. That's another real feel-good moment where, like, yes, I figured out this thing that resolves both these problems. And
yeah,
you know, and usually that's going to be a simplification as well if it's just that one thing.
Unless you're adding another rule, don't add more rules. Don't do it.
Yeah. How about you, Daniel? What do you prefer to do, like the one change at a time, multiple changes at a time, or how do you approach, you know, kind of managing the changes between iterations?
So like I said, I do that kind of like one test and then two tests and then three tests and all that stuff. Usually early on, that's when I do my most drastic changes. I'll do one test and I'll see everything's kind of falling apart. Here's all the mess, but I'll find that one nugget that's actually really good. And then I'll just kind of keep that and change everything else to support that nugget and let it grow. I'm not sure what that nugget is made of that's growing, but
let's call it a seed.
Just go with a seed. Yes. Yeah. Seed is good. So I'll kind of like take two tests and then I'll update that and still keep that one thing that I liked from that first test and then see what else is supporting that really well and what is a little more shaky. And then I'll change that. And gradually, as these cycles go on, less and less will need to be changed, either because I'll realize that at a certain point the game is just not working, so I need to put it aside, or it is working, and I just need to make some minor refinements. And honestly, it's usually those minor, tiny little refinements that take the most development time to figure out, because, one, they're tiny, so it takes time to figure out where they are and what problems they're presenting, and also it just takes time to figure out what the solution is to those tiny things.
Yeah. One thing that I've noticed too is if you're playtesting early and things fall apart, that's common. That happens all the time. But if that happens and you don't see that seed of something that you really like, then it may not be worth pursuing, right?
Oh, yeah.
You know, part of iteration isn't necessarily pushing ahead at all costs with this thing and hoping that the magic part of it is, we'll just show up sometime later. That I've seen people do that, and they're like, well, no, you know, it's the sunk cost thing. It's like, well, I've worked so much on this. It's something, right? Probably, right? If I just keep going, it'll be fine. You need to know when to bail, and iteration can help with that too.
So what is the point? Do you have any experience where you've bailed on a design?
Constantly.
Yeah? So what's your threshold?
I mean, I think that's the part where you really have to go with your gut. I think that seed of what's working, you feel it as a designer. You know, if you have that spark in you that makes you want to keep going, there's something that will make you want to push yourself, to make you devote the time to seeing this thing come to fruition. And it's an important part of the process to keep trying until you find something that does that, especially everything feels like that in your head, and then you make it, and it may not actually come out that way. It's also one of those things maybe you give it a play or two to make sure that it's not falling apart because of other things.
How about you, Daniel? When do you know when to just kind of, you know, set the design aside or punt it?
So sometimes I'll find that out really early on where, like, when I mean early on, I mean literally just like tweeting the idea. And I'll hear back from people saying, hey, that there's this other game that does that, or this other game does that. And so I'll just look up that game and find out, oh, hey, they actually used this idea, and either it didn't work out for them, or it did, but they didn't explore it in this other way, or it didn't work out, but it wasn't because they did it wrong. There's still that idea that's still actually kind of good. That's the kind of thing where I'll do a very fast filter, where I'll like, okay, I've got a lot of game ideas coming in at any particular time, and I can't support all of them, and so... I mean, it's the thing. Like, I think
if you want like 14 game design ideas an hour, follow Daniel on Twitter. He's prolific. He puts out like a game a month still, even though he doesn't want to.
And the thing is, that's only a slight hyperbole.
But you know, those things come fast, and so I just don't have the time to pursue all of them. So I need a filtering system to get rid of the ones that aren't fruitful or don't have potential to yield results. And I've gotten better about that. It used to be that I would spend too much time pursuing a game that just wasn't going to go anywhere. But in time, after you do it, you know, dozens and dozens of times, you start getting a better instinct about what things actually have potential and what things don't really.
Right. And once you get down the road and you've made a game or two, it's not hard to push yourself to want to filter out the bad things. You devote so much time when you finally start making an idea into an actual product that you just, for your own time's sake, want to make sure that it's exactly what you need. So it's not hard once you've gone down that path to know when to course correct.
Yeah, I think Eric Lang just said recently that his advice was any professional designer should have more ideas than they have time to develop. And I think that's what helps with iteration too, is that you can iterate and know what to cut and know what to drop and be comfortable with that because you already have five or six other ideas in the back burner that you're ready to pick up any time.
Yeah, I think Eric says that like every 3 months because people need to be reminded. So Dan, you sort of talked about the filtering. I guess I would almost call it like a stillborn idea. Mm-hmm. What about an idea that you've developed for a while? How do you know when to just, you know what, this isn't working?
I had that happen, actually. You mentioned River Ancient. That was a tile-laying game that I was tinkering with the idea of taking the river phase of Carcassonne and making that an entire game. I was trying to figure out, like, okay, a lot of people don't like the river phase in a Carcassonne because it seems just autopilot, that you just do whatever, and better to just have it randomly set up so that you don't have to spend playtime developing this thing. And I was thinking, well, what if there actually was a reason? What if you used mechanics that referred to things being downstream or upstream, establishing things on the riverbanks or further away? There's interesting geographic things that you could do with that. And so I started developing mechanics for that and making it sort of a tile and dice game where you would place tiles to build the river, and then you would place a randomly rolled die at the vertices of tiles so that you essentially establish a settlement. And the pips on the die face that you place there would represent how many of your settlers you had on that river. And then once I think it was something about like there was an area majority thing where if you surrounded a tile with more pips on those corners of your tribe, then you got a thing, and it was like some mechanics that were revolved around that. I tested it and tested it and tested it, and I did some significant changes during that unpub, and I kept pursuing it. I even brought to another unpub mini, I think, or another game design meeting once, and I honestly just didn't have the passion for it, especially with the production costs that it would have. Like, I knew that it would have to go to a publisher, and it would have to be tiles, and it would have to have dice. And that means that the game would be heavy, which would mean that it's a tough sell to a publisher. And that means that I'll have to be very particular about which publisher I pitch to, And if I have to be very particular about a publisher I pitch to, then that means I probably need to see them in person, which means I have to go to a convention to go see them. I could see the branching futures for this game, and none of them were things that I had the emotional budget to really pursue aggressively, when I had so many other games that would be much easier to release on my own and start earning, honestly, just earning money and paying bills before this game would ever see the light of day. So it wasn't necessarily, I mean, the design was tough, and I'm sure that that's part that contributed to it. But more than anything, I just knew that it was something I needed to put away because I had others that could be done sooner. It's a weird, I don't think that applies necessarily. I don't know how universal that is, but that's what kind of made me stop developing that game.
So I guess you weighed the pros and the cons, and you're saying, you know, the list of cons is larger than the amount of pros for me to continue to develop this game. And so I'm going to put it on the back burner or on the, you know, closet of misfit, you know, designs, and then it's going to be there. I remember playing that, and it definitely has potential. And I understand why you would shelve it, you know, given the constraints, you know, that you operate under. Hopefully you'll come back to that at some point.
You know, I think there's value in designing things that don't see the market too, right? Like I, on the back burner for a few months earlier this year, I was working on a cooperative game. I think every designer should make a back burner quixotic bid at a cooperative game just to get it out of your system, because man, is that a disaster. But I had this game, it's called Snowbiz. It's it was about running a plow crew in a blizzard.
Awesome.
The idea was cool, and it was all built around this idea of having cards out, like having cards or tiles out in a grid, but using the negative space rather than the cards themselves. And there was some merit there, and I kept pushing it and kept pushing it, but just the moment to moment didn't work. But there was a lot about that where I sort of farmed ideas and mechanics, and I have a lot of things I'd really like to use out of that, and those are now in my toolkit, and I can bust those out when appropriate. But you can kind of push along a bad idea and then, you know, abandon it for scrap.
Yeah. I forget who said it, but there's no development time that's truly wasted. That even if you put a project aside or put a game aside, what you learn from that development time is valuable for the next thing you do.
Yeah, I think Gil Hova just said something similar about a game he scrapped a long time ago, and bits of that turned into Battle Merchants and The Networks. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, Graham, your experience is definitely not singular. In that respect. And if you don't call that game Mr. Plow, if you ever return to it, we're not speaking again. All right.
Sorry, I'm not going to name something not a pun. It's just not going to happen.
Oh, sorry. I was going to push for Senor Plow so that you could do the song.
That would also work, yes.
Well, you know.
So
be up with that license, and we'll see.
You don't even need the license. You just need the title. No. So when you are... making iterations, how do you track what changes between iterations? And I guess, do you even track? Or, you know, is it just all up in your head?
So I don't trust my head. I have a list, you know, I have my folder with the game, and I have 0.1, 0.2, 0.3, 0.4, and I'll make notes about what I'm changing, and then have the full version of everything. If I need to roll back, it's all there. So, yeah, it's wow. Interesting in that way. Yeah, I think it's important to keep that, not just because, you know, maybe you need to roll back or iterate, but also you can kind of learn from going back and looking at your iterations, right? Especially that's a way to know if you've gone off course. Sometimes something you scrap early on in the process could be really useful later in the process once you've fixed other problems. Like, you know, actually, this thing could work here in the game that totally doesn't resemble my 0.2 version of the game. Again, no development time's wasted, right? For example, on Party Politics, I was originally having it have a lot more partisan affiliation ties, and it was a little too much. I had to scale it back. Once I was done scaling it back and I've gotten it down to just kind of the base level, there was one little piece of the interaction between players that I wanted to bring back, and I could go back and like, all right, well, I don't have to reinvent this thing. I still have it in 0.2 rules, copy, paste, change three words, you can keep going that way. But mostly, I think it's just to go back and have the perspective.
Does that stem from like your OCD nature?
I think everything in my life stems from that, Matt.
Yeah, I'm actually pretty bad about tracking iterations. I got to get better. And I was at Gen Con this year. I was playing some of TC Petty's designs, and he opened up his design notebook where he was jotting down, you know, feedback and ideas. And I'm looking at how detailed and very organized his notebook is. And I'm like, wow, that's really impressive. I think I need to try to step up my game here.
I don't know. I mean, you're doing pretty well. I think everybody kind of works differently in that regard.
Right.
That is true. And this, I mean, no method is right for everyone. No advice is right for everyone. I mean, that's very true.
Mark said that.
Yeah. yes. Mark's meta advice, which is good all the time. Yeah. You know, but at the same point, I do think it's, I don't know if I'd say important, but I think it's a good practice to try to do things in a different way than you have been, and just to see if you discover something that might work better for yourself. And so I don't know if I would try to be like really disciplined and, you know, have the very detailed, you know, change log essentially, that might work out better for me. I don't know yet. And yeah, I have to try to force myself to try to do that.
I know one of the things that we're trying to do now with after every meeting is that we're going to do more thorough posts about our experience playtesting other people's games.
Right.
I think that's going to be an interesting opportunity for me to be a little more diligent about when I run my own playtests, recording what my experiences were there and what I found there. So that's maybe the closest I can get. I'm really undisciplined otherwise.
Yeah, and I hope, you know, that is one of the points of posting like that. It's to try to jog, you know, memories and keep a history.
Of course, the great thing about doing, you know, game design in the analog sense that we do, like, since you're a one-person shop, you can kind of come up with your own thing. If something works better for you than others, this isn't just that, you know, advice is different for everyone, but the nature of it is such that if your system works for you, that's fine. You know, most people don't do co-designs, or they always do co-designs with the same people or what have you. People aren't going to blindly go back and look at your game design and try to finish it. Like, it's yours. And you can work how you need to work, which is helpful. You don't have to do like pure documentation, like in code or something, where it's like, no, just in case, look, I got to future-proof this so someone can finish my little card game.
Yeah, it is kind of a software thing, isn't it, to do all that documentation?
Totally. Yeah, yeah. I mean, having the not only the revision history, but if you're using any type of source management where you'll have literally all the old revisions of things, that's very much a software paradigm, yeah, to have all that. I'm not sure what kind of computer you use, Graham, but, you know, Daniel, you and I
use all of them.
So, you know, if you're on a Mac, you have built-in revision history with Time Machine. And so it's actually really nice if you have rules or files locally to go back and like, well, yeah, okay, I got to revert back to that, you know, thing from 3 months ago because it turns out the branch that I went down on this design, I'm way off. So I'm just going to go find that from 3 months ago, and then you're golden. You don't even have to manually do those branches anymore. So actually, that's going to lead into our next question here, and I didn't even realize I was doing this.
segue.
So, yes, segue. It was an excellent segue. So how do you know when to roll back to a previous iteration if you kind of go down a design path that just, you know, isn't working?
I don't think there's a universal answer, right? Theoretically, if you play test correctly, most of the time, you start down a path because you've made your one change and you see that one change didn't help things and you can pull back. But we don't live in that world. You miss some things. You get down the path. It's hard to say, right? When do you roll back? I think it's purely situational.
Have you had a time where you've had to do that?
Yeah. So remember when I was talking about how I started The Fittest in 2006 and finished it in 2013? There were about four rollbacks on that. The game originally started as a co-design with Brad Talton about a magical school. At one point, it was sort of an American Gladiators sort of thing that actually ended with this really elaborate, you know, Eliminator-style obstacle course. You can go down paths and get all the way down them and then like, this didn't work out great. So, you know, you have to roll back completely or partially, but I think at any step in the process, if you aren't afraid to try to figure out what that that seed is that works.
Not nugget. You know, it's not a nugget.
Yeah, seed. Well, yeah. You know, it feels like it. Okay. but I think it's important to let yourself feel like you can push away the extras and get to that at any given moment. Anything you add should feel like it needs to be there. And yeah, until you say I'm done, then you need to keep your focus on that seed, on that core idea. And yeah, maybe you don't pick up on it later, but when do you roll back? As soon as you notice? You know?
It seems like that might be analogous to when you know to punt on a design.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah, you know, you're getting to the point where it's just not working, but you have such a design history that you think you can roll back and pick it up somewhere else, maybe. You know, is that what you're thinking, Daniel?
Yeah, kind of. A lot of times, there's two ways it could go for me. Sometimes I'll go too far intentionally, mainly to reaffirm the decisions that I've made up to that point. So I'll like scrap everything, try something completely different, using the same theme, maybe same like victory conditions or something like that, and it'll just fall apart. It's terrible because it's basically a different game. But it helps me to like reaffirm, okay, I was in a good place. I need to go back to that. Or yeah, it can split and it becomes two different games, and they just kind of had the same roots. So.
And that is brilliant because that's going to segue into our next question. So what do you do when that happens? When you have, you know, either feedback or ideas that are going to cause your game to go in two different directions? Do you split it into two? Do you pick a direction? What do you do?
This is interesting because I think, you know, I've been testing Party Politics, and an exact issue with this came up a couple of months ago when we were playtesting it at the meeting. You know, there was an issue with the point values in the turns, right? Where there was this idea to have randomized point structure. And that's interesting, but I think a lot of the game, and at least having a large group game, it's important that it's accessible to people who aren't necessarily super into games. And, you know, it should have a low barrier to entry. So I'm always cognizant of the actual audience for the thing, and it may be not lining up with the exact group I'm playtesting with at the moment. But if you want to branch out, if there's like, well, this is a promising idea, but it's not what I'm working on, then you can start that. I mean, that you just had a new idea for a game. And as the person who came up with the original game, you know, it can be similar to your other game. You can follow that path down, and there might be something good there, something with the core edition of the game more than the family edition of the game or whatever. I think there's probably some ideas that Daniel had with his recent game. We've been talking about seeds and branches. Seems like Daniel's got a lot of tree games on his mind.
Yeah, we've just been setting the scene. That's what we've been doing.
Yeah.
So I know, Daniel, you had, you know, you put out Kigi, mm-hmm. and then it has morphed into something else. Have you had, so in there, it seemed like you had one kind of direction to go, right, to make it something else. Have you had the situation where you've kind of had two divergent directions that you could possibly go with a design?
Yeah, I mean, Kigi was actually in itself one offshoot of a tile laying idea that I had. Basically, the two parallel games are Light Rail and Kigi. And at first glance, they don't look anything at all alike. But in both games, I was exploring using cards as tiles, doing things that cards in particular were adept at doing. And so rather than trying to force the poker-sized cards that I had available to me to produce through print on demand, rather than force them to fit, try to do things that square tiles could do, I really just wanted to figure out things that cards could do, but still be a tile laying game. And so I just started literally getting a bunch of like playing cards, putting them on a table, and figuring out, okay, how can they do grids? How can they be arranged? Oh, well, interesting. They stack and they overlap each other very well. Tiles can't really do that very, very effectively because they're too thick.
I believe that was a 5-part tweet that day.
Yeah. Yeah. More or less. And so that became eventually that developed into Kigi. And I had an idea for this. This is going back like years ago, when Kigi sort of morphed into that. But as a part of that also, I in that development process, I had arranged these cards into a brick pattern so that they were offset from each other. And I realized essentially that that sort of makes a
hex grid.
It's sort of a hex grid,
yeah.
in a way. And so I started working in that direction for Light Rail. But then there's like, as you mentioned, there's a more recent branch where Kigi has now has sort of branched off to become Kodama, that's being published by Action Phase Games. And that's an interesting experience because essentially Action Phase, they liked Kiki, they found some issues with it, and they essentially started developing on their end at the sort of pace that I would normally playtest a prototype. They kind of approached Kiki as if it was already a prototype. And so they looked at it from that perspective, and so they just did dozens and dozens and dozens of plays, assuming that it's a play test. And from there, they essentially made it a different game. It has the same core mechanic, but it is very much a different game, and they don't really like they're not cross compatible, and they have different structures and all sorts of other stuff. Different theme, obviously. What was interesting about that experience is that essentially this initial seed of exploring the physicality of cards has branched off into like all sorts of different weird things that I could have just as easily left Light Rail on my shelf and pursued Kiki or vice versa. But I think the nice thing about the way I've been working is that because of the low overhead that I have for production, I have the freedom to pursue both of those branches and follow both of those paths and see where they go. And sometimes they lead to really cool things.
So, I mean, would you say designers should try to follow both, or should they pick one and focus and then maybe bounce back and forth? What do you think would be kind of like the best practice to follow there?
Okay, I'm giving this advice to whoever's listening, and they're faced with that fork in the road, like in the poem, and they're trying to figure out which path to go down. If you can afford to double back and go pursue the other path, then yeah, go try both. But if for whatever reason, and I don't just mean monetarily. I mean like emotionally, just with your energy, whatever time you have available to you, because for most people, it's not a day job. If you don't have the emotional or just the spoons, as the metaphor goes, if you don't have the spoons to pursue both paths, then just go with one and you don't have to worry about the other one because it's still there. It's not going anywhere and no one else is going to be going down that path because they've got their own paths to go down. This kind of turns self-help, sorry.
Game design is self-help, so
that's
okay.
That's true. I think it's important to make sure you pursue one. Don't pursue both and then mess up and not finish either one,
Yeah.
Choose one and really see it through. And I think if you've gone down that path and you still feel like, well, this is working, like it's not that you need to roll back to that. There's actually something over here too. Then, if you have the energy then, but that's a pretty good litmus test for whether you should go back and make something different.
I haven't faced this myself yet. I know I will at some point, and I honestly don't know which way I would go. I mean, I think I would probably try to satisfy my gamer instincts, and that would be to make it more gamery, in that case. I don't know. Yeah, it'll be interesting if that happens, if I have to have a fork and decide on a direction.
Just flip a coin. Roll a die.
Yeah, yeah.
Make it a game.
Make a game out of how to make a game, yeah. So the next question here comes from friend of the show, Chris Mosley. And he asks, how do you stay interested in a project through the finish line? And it seems to me that at some point you would have to grow weary of tinkering with a game given the amount of time it takes to bring it to market. Ooh. Yeah, this is a big question. So we'll start with you, Daniel. So, how do you stay interested in something that you're working on?
Well, I actually have a real problem with this because I get bored easily. I have really bad discipline with this kind of thing. So I'm the worst at it. And that was partly the way I dealt with that was giving myself a short development cycle and a very rapid release schedule for 1 year. I was just fortunate that this came about right at the same time that Drive-Thru Cards was starting up, and they were pretty affordable. So I could tell myself, all right, if I release a game, if I finish a game, because I had like 8 or 9 different games that I had at basically like 75 to 90% development stage. And for whatever reason, I had grown bored or moved on to something else. I just told myself, okay, you got to get this stuff done. And here is your schedule to get it done. Just do the last 10% that needs to be done on them and then move them out the door. Whether they're good or bad, it's going to have to just fall to fate. But playtest, of course, try to make them good, but you got to get them done. And that was how I kind of like hacked my psychology a little bit to keep my attention focused on one game at a time, because I knew that I was facing a deadline. Now that I've gone past that point where I'm not doing that very rapid release schedule anymore, it's creeping up on me again. Where the game I was developing at the last Unpub was a kart racing game, and I ended up putting that aside for about 3 or 4 months because I suddenly was lured away by the prospects for Trickster and how much more quickly I could develop that and release that and kind of make that a profitable enterprise. I'm coming back to that kart racing game now with some fresh eyes, and I think that's a thing that I've done a lot in my career right from the very start when I was working on one role-playing game for years and years and years and years, and then I offhandedly kind of almost flippantly pitched this other game idea. Then that became very popular all of a sudden, and so I decided, okay, well, I'm gonna publish that. And then so it leapfrogged, the second game kind of leapfrogged the first, but that second game gave me the license to not put all my eggs in the basket of that first game and do things a little more freely with that first game that I wouldn't have felt if I still had that as my one precious one ring.
Yeah. Gotcha. Yeah. So I think it sounds to me like deadlines are crucial for you.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Self-imposed or otherwise, deadlines are very, very good for keeping my attention.
Gotcha. Gotcha. All right, Graham. So same question for you.
So at some point, making a game into a finished product is work. Mm-hmm. And I think that's important when you're coming in. There's going to be a point where you are tired of trying to fix this thing. It's no longer fun in itself to make these things. That doesn't necessarily mean you're doing it wrong. It's just that your focus needs to be on the rewarding nature of finishing the thing and getting it out to the world. Coming up with ideas is fun, right? Then it's the hard part. So just like any work, you got to prevent burnout, right? You got to take a break. You got to, you know, pitch a 13-card micro game in a shady alley. You got to do what you got to do. You know, take a break, go work on something else, have something on the back burner for, you know, that sort of outlet, because you're not constantly putting new creative ideas into this game when you're trying to get it done. And yeah, that's 90% of it. The part where you're really like putting in a lot of creative energy is early on. So the important thing, I think, is to remember your goal. And your goal is to make a game that people play, right? You know, if you really just want to make a game for yourself, you can be thinking of a game like, oh, that'd be a fun game. Great. And then just move on with your life. To get it to other people, you need to get it out of your head. And that's tough.
This job would be so much easier if it wasn't for all the other players.
Yeah, you know? But, you know, at a certain point, you're tired of playing your game. I love when I see people playing The Fittest. I don't necessarily want to play it myself. I have played it to death, you know? I have, like, 16 different versions of the rules in my head, and that's just a disaster. But I think if you want to have fun playing a game, play other people's games. If you want to work on your project, work on it. You know, it is a job. It is, you know, even if you're just doing it for fun, you're doing it on the side, you really have to put this sort of willpower to it that you would with a 9-to-5.
I believe it was Drew in the last episode. He expressed a very similar sentiment that, you know, it is work and you have to realize that. And you just have to use whatever, hesitate to call them mental tricks, but whatever, you know, whatever motivation you have, you know, to make you do the work. You know, that's what you have to do.
Like a profound fear of failure. You know, if all you have to keep going is, I don't want to have wasted the last 3 years of my life, fine. Just channel it into finishing the game, right? I mean, don't be afraid to fail. You know, don't push it past the finish line if it's not any good. But if it's like, this is good and I need to make it what it needs to be, then that can drive you. But it's not like, oh, hey, this fun thing I got. I know a lot of people who are amateur game designers who are just like, oh, look, I made this thing. Isn't it pretty cool? Great. Here, we can play it. Change it? Nah, I'm good. Here it is. And they have fun, you know, trotting out their little trinket. It can be so much more if you work on it.
For a second there, I thought you were going to go with, like, the ultimate deadline is mortality. You just have to get it done before you die.
You know? In which case, you should probably have good documentation and all your stuff just in case you miss deadline. That way somebody can go back and finish your game. Right?
Yeah. That it's a half joke, it's half truth, you know. I mean, that's
write it in your will. It's like, I bequeath my game design work to the guild. It's your fleet to finish it and play it at my funeral.
That's right. Yeah, at the wake, you know, after I'm in the ground. That's right.
The final playtest. Yeah.
So the last question we have, are there any best practices for iterating a design that you'd like to share that we haven't already talked about?
Yeah, you know, we've kind of covered a lot of best practices, I think. Again, I think the thing I'd push the most is try to limit what you do every time to fix it. Don't go overboard. There's two schools of it, right? There are people who have to keep convincing themselves that their game is fallible and that they need to change it. And then there's the uncontrollable need to make the game what people want it to be. Usually people fall on one side of that spectrum or the other. For me, I definitely want to be a people pleaser. I want to fix that thing that you said, but just restraint in either way. Don't ignore overwhelming evidence that you need to change your game, and also don't jump at the drop of a hat to change it either. Moderation in all things. We're talking about global advice. You know,
this got deep.
Yeah,
chill a little bit.
Well, you know? we are here to also espouse philosophy, not just game design. Yes,
we are not philosophers. We are not doctors. We are not psychiatrists. I don't know. We're going to talk about stuff anyway.
How about you, Daniel? Do you have anything else you want to share that we haven't already talked about?
Yeah, something that I think doesn't get mentioned a lot, but it's a piece of advice that I heard from Susan McKinley Ross, who designed Quirkle. She had an interview on another podcast, I think Game Design University. She was saying that the advice that she always hears from game designers is to playtest with strangers who don't have anything invested and will tell you the truth about your game. And she said that's valuable, and I, you know, I still think that's valuable too, but she had another piece of advice that I think is a good counterpoint to that. When you're doing your first playtests, put them in front of people that you can trust who are good at first playtests, because that is an unusual skill that not a lot of people have and not a lot of people have any interest in doing.
Right. Hey, play this bad, broken game.
Yeah.
That I drew out on index cards. Yeah.
Yeah. Not a lot of people are going to sit down and try your recipe that you just made up. But some people will, and cherish them and you respect their time and work with them initially when you're doing your very, very first tests. And they can be family. They can be the people that you trust and that are your friends. But start with those people as your first play testers before you go to the strangers, because the strangers can easily, you know, they tell you the truth, but they can also take away your motivation to keep on keeping on. And so that's the one piece of advice that I probably go with.
Yeah, I do all my initial playtests either with myself or with my wife Marcy, and she won't hold back because, you know, she has no reason to. And I think the other aspect that I'm not sure if she was implying this or not is that if you're playtesting with that group that's really good about first playtests, and most likely you know them well,
yes,
they probably aren't going to hold back.
Right.
Right.
They'll be honest with you, but they're also going to be useful and valuable.
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And
it's not just this game is not working. Well, we know it's not working. It's early. Right?
Yeah.
So it's not just they need to be frank, but also understanding that they're about to play a bad game and probably not have fun.
Right.
That's not necessarily a problem.
Right. And not worry about hurting feelings. Right. I mean, hammer it. That's what we got to do, because that's how you're going to fix it. All right. Very good. This is a really, really good discussion about iterating your designs. Hopefully a lot of people will get some good nuggets or seeds out of this episode. All right. So now we're going to move into our news segment. So we have a couple things to talk about this episode. The first one is just earlier today, Avalanche at Yeti Mount was successfully funded.
Yay!
Thank you. It ended up at 17,500 with 771 backers. What's really funny about that is the exact same number of backers for Wombat Rescue, which was my previous one. And so I don't know what that means, if that's just, you know, karma or cosmic, or I don't know. It's just, I don't know. I thought that was funny. The exact same number of backers.
That is peculiar.
Yeah, yeah, it really is. So thank you everyone out there who backed or tweeted or shared or helped me playtest or any of that. Could not have done it without you. This was, in the end, it worked out, but man, this was a long, stressful campaign, because for a while it wasn't funded. It only funded like 3 days ago, and that's never a good feeling when it's sitting out there unfunded. But we're all good now, and we're going to get started on nailing down the rule book. I mean, the rules are done. Now it's the language, which is the tough part, and finishing up the art and trying to get this out to the printers as quickly as we can. Next piece of news. Daniel, this is yours. Go ahead and tell us about this.
Kodama is going to be hitting Kickstarter very, very shortly. October 13th, 2015 is the launch date for the Kickstarter campaign, and it's going to be running for about 30 days, I believe, just stopping just shy of the week of Thanksgiving in the United States. But it's ironic because it's actually starting the day after Canadian Thanksgiving. So we're like kind of like right in that sandwich of fall goodness, which is really fun.
It's a turkey sandwich.
Yeah. Yes. Okay. So, but yeah, it's going to be launching then. Action Phase Games is producing it. They've done an amazing job developing it to a very, very cool. It's just a cool game now. It's just. I mean, people liked Kiki before. I think if you like Kiki, you're going to really love this game. And if you never played Kiki, you're good because this is a fantastic game on its own. Check it out. It's got really amazing art by Quan Chai Maria. Scott, Nick, and Travis from Action Phase have done an amazing job. And I'm really excited to see how it turns out.
And I want to emphasize, if you're listening to this, go look at the art that is posted to BoardGameGeek. It really is phenomenal. It is. I mean, Quan Chai is amazing just to start with. That guy, I saw him at Origins this past year, and not what I was expecting at all. Like, he looked like an office drone, you know? and I was expecting, you know, like an artist type of, I don't know, like long hair or crazy clothes or something. No, he was very professional, like, you know, close-cropped hair and very, like, business casual attire. And I was like, really? You're? Wow, okay. No, not at all. Really nice guy, though. Stellar work. So definitely go check out all the art that has been uploaded to BoardGameGeek.
Yeah.
All right, the next one, Graham, this is yours.
Yeah, so I've been talking about Party Politics a little bit. I'm opening up to open playtesting in just a couple weeks in mid-October. So if you're interested in being a part of the playtesting group, you should hit me up on Twitter at ColorNinja, on BoardGameGeek, username ColorNinja, or send an email to graham@colorninja.com. Or just, you know, talk to anyone at the Game Designers North Carolina. They'll probably point you in the right direction. But I'm going to be sending out some print-and-play prototypes for playtesting later this month. You should know that it is a 4-to-8-player game, so if you usually only play 2-player stuff, then, you know, it may not be your thing, but a lot of people are liking it, so I'm interested to see people's takes on it.
So give the, like, the 60-second pitch of kind of what the theme and what the gameplay is like.
Right, so Party Politics is a pseudo-cooperative game, as cooperative as partisan politics is in real life, in that it's not, but it appears to be, that there's some cooperation. The idea is that you are a member of a political party, and you're running for office, but you need to get the primary nomination and then beat the other party. So there's this working against each other in your party to try to be the nominee, but then when the general election comes up, it's sort of how many resources do you want to devote to taking out the opposition. You get some points if your party wins, but more if you're the nominee. So it's this divided loyalties, whether you need to be selfish at the moment or whether party unity is selfish for you at the moment. It's, I think, an interesting dynamic that hasn't been seen in a lot of social games. And yeah, so I'm curious what people think about it.
Yeah, I've played this twice now, and I agree. It has some really interesting social dynamics that at least I haven't seen in a social game, not to say that it's not out there somewhere, but I do think it's pretty unique. And if you have a group of, you know, again, 4-to-8 players, if you like those social games, definitely check this out and give Graham some good feedback. Is this still 54 cards, or is this more
it's
now?
It's up to 70 now.
Okay.
Because of some valuable, you know, feedback and iteration from the Game Designers of North Carolina. It is still a very small, streamlined, contained game that's really easy for people to understand. So you can, say, play it with 8 people at once without having, you know, a big lead up and a lot of time. It plays pretty quickly, 40 to 60 minutes usually. So it's a lot of fun in sort of larger social settings. It's great if you like politics because it's really into that. But it's also great if you don't like politics, because I've definitely seen people interpret it as a very biting sort of social commentary about self-interest in politics.
Right.
So it's not about the politics, but it's inspired by it.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. So, don't let if you're not into political themes, don't let that dissuade you. Yeah, definitely check this out if you've got a group that's interested in it. All right, very good. So, Graham, you already shared your Twitter handles. Daniel, where can people find you?
You can find me at Daniel Solis on Twitter. I tweet entirely too much.
He does. It's great, but it's not – you have to say it's too much.
It's a fire hose. It's, yeah.
At times, yeah, and that's okay. It's almost always very interesting.
It's a delightful, refreshing fire hose.
That's right. Yeah, just, you know, wear good shoes so you have traction.
Flip-flops.
And you can find me on Twitter at Matt Wolf, E on the end of Wolf, and it's the same username on BoardGameGeek, because I am super lazy and somehow managed to grab it. So if you have enjoyed this episode, please join our guild on BoardGameGeek. If you go to podcast.gdofnc.com, which stands for Game Designers of North Carolina, that's going to redirect you to our guild on BoardGameGeek. Because did you know you cannot actually search for a guild? It's ridiculous. So the only way you can go there is if you have the URL, or you have a URL redirect like we do. So if you want to subscribe, join in on the conversation. We usually try to talk about each episode. And we also have a group Twitter account that you can follow, which is at gdofnc.com. And the person running that account will most likely make fun of you if you tweet at them, and that's okay. You can also subscribe to the podcast using iTunes, Stitcher, or through the RSS feed that is provided by our podcast host, which is Buzzsprout. And that will do it for this episode of the Game Designers of North Carolina podcast. Remember to never invite Mr. Bendy Card to game night, and we will see you next time.